Hello, and welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. A bonus episode to our first section that had to do with service dogs and comfort animals and therapy dogs, the whole thing. But recently there was an article in our major newspaper on Vashon, the 200-page Beachcomber, and it had to do with our guest today. Her name is Lola Michelin. She's a director of education at Northwest School for Animal Massage. And right away, animal massage kind of got me with the whole thing there. And she works out here on the island, and from what I understand, pretty much any place that animals need massage or assistance. So with that, let's talk about animal massage. And it seems to me that having a service dog that, and we talk about massage, animals have a lot of the same kinds of needs that humans do. We're all animals in this world in some respect. And I never really thought about massage, but that is what Lola does. So, Lola, tell me what your typical day looks like, and we can get into more follow-up questions as we get into this a little more.
Sure, sure. Well, firstly, just thank you so much to both you and Maya for having me here today to talk about animal massage. And yes, you're correct. Many of the benefits that we derive from massage are going to be the same for our pets. So some people use animal massage to help with relieving anxiety in their pets. Oftentimes it's used to help with relieving pain or helping with immobility. Some of the things that we see, age-related conditions with dogs, will benefit from massage. So while dogs may...
Things like arthritis, possibly?
Absolutely, correct. And we work really closely with people's vet care team and other healthcare professionals to ensure that the animal is getting all the things addressed that they need, whether they're physical conditions or whether it's emotional or psychological conditions. So we have people... graduates of ours who specialize more in behavioral sessions, working with dogs from a behavioral standpoint. I tend to focus more on sporting animals, service animals, as well as geriatric animals. And those dogs also really see a lot of benefit from the work. They might receive it differently than you or I. Their experience of it might be a little bit different. And so we have to adapt our style of providing the massage to meet the dog's needs. But I have yet to meet an animal, honestly, that didn't receive some benefit and enjoy the work as well.
Yeah, I heard the statement one time that said, some of my best friends are animals. And I think that's real true. I was one of the things that you mentioned I was really interested in, and you were talking about, you know, behavioral aspects. And I've had some friends that have rescued dogs, particularly... Mm-hmm. pit bulls that have been at some point trained for fighting.
Yes.
And just have horrible trauma. Is that something that they might work with? Animals that have, I mean, animals must have trauma just like.
Absolutely.
Almost like PTSD kind of thing.
Yeah, we might not recognize the signs of that, but, you know, talking about service dogs, we do see like signs of compassion fatigue in animals that are working in service roles or like search and rescue dogs. Rescue has become such a popular thing for people to get their animals from shelters or sanctuaries, which is fabulous, but oftentimes they do come with a history. And so helping to address those traumatic pasts, massage can be a valuable tool in that. For example, years ago, we went to Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, the Northwest School of Animal Massage. We taught classes there for many years. And in one instance, another fellow Islander, Wendy Dahl, and I went there specifically to meet with the behavioral specialist there and learn how we could modify approaches to working with animals. Now, some people may be familiar with Best Friends Animal Sanctuary. It's a large sanctuary located in Utah, and they actually took in the vast majority of what they called the victory dogs, the Michael Vick dogs.
We were just down, we drove right by that.
Yeah. Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were fortunate enough to meet a number of those dogs and work with them, and many of them did have mental scars from their experiences that took years for them to overcome. But there's a beautiful book that some of the caretakers at Best Friends wrote about the victory dogs. You know, the majority of those dogs ended up in homes where they were either service dogs, working dogs, or emotional support dogs, which just speaks to the resiliency of these animals emotionally when they're in the right environment with the right care.
That's interesting because my second service dog, and her name is Ellen, was also trained out at the prison. And they think at some point, one of the guards, during the evening, one of the guards may have teased her because when she was at my house, at one time I had a health care worker come over to help me. And she was all in dark scrubs.
Oh, interesting.
And also a person who was going to do a bit on my roof who was in all dark, kind of a fleece jacket. Mm-hmm. And Ellen just would not have anything. She somehow associated that dark uniform or those dark colors with a guard's uniform. Mm-hmm. Which is very much, I think, and just was under the table, was right by me, hackles were up. And so I think that, to me, kind of goes to show that she may have experienced some trauma with that.
Oh, it is interesting what will serve as a trigger. And even though, like, animals' neurobiology, the neuroscience of most animals is different than ours, you know, we don't have the same kind of frontal lobe activity in animals that we do in humans, which is sometimes to their benefit because I think that does assist their resiliency and kind of letting go of past traumas. But we do all have that kind of reptilian brain, our limbic system, that's just responsive to certain stimuli. And for dogs, if they associate something with a behavior or a response for themselves, then even later in life, that trigger can come up, just like for people. So sometimes it is kind of helping them with either desensitizing them to that trigger or replacing that trigger with a positive experience enough times to override that. And, you know, sometimes massage and other therapies like acupressure can help to open that door so that we can introduce other types of training. And I know the work that they do out at Purdy, at the women's prison to help with these dogs, it's transformative, not just for the women that work with those dogs, but certainly the dogs themselves who often come there with histories that involve trauma.
You know, they also have a program out there called Paroled Pets, which is one that I really love.
Yeah.
The dogs that don't quite have the either emotional or maybe there is some trauma that don't exactly make it all the way to be a full service animal, they're still do all their commands, are still very well-trained dogs,
right.
And they put those dogs out at as paroled pets. And also, I've been out to Echo Glen, which is out by North Bend. It's the student, well, not student, the youth detention center. Mm. And it's the state detention center there. And they house youths that are 18 and younger, many for very serious crimes, murder, and those kinds of things. And they also do dog training out there.
Right.
I think Charlie Rosenberry on the island at one time worked out there with that group. Let me ask a dumb question because, okay, I watched a program on TV last night called Heartland, and it's about a family that basically deals with horses that have kind of behavior issues.
Yeah.
And one of the things that she did was she said there's a place on the top of the horse's head that they massage to kind of reduce anxiety. Are there pressure points like that for the horse?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The body is just a tremendous map. And so there's lots of locations that create specific physiological effects. That's one of the things that our students cover a lot in courses is, you know, where do we find these places on the body that elicit certain responses? And horses do have areas around what we call the pole, where the skull and the neck meet, or just between and behind the ears, where there's just a rich innervation. There's a lot of nerve beds there that do link directly into the rest and relax system, right? The what we call the parasympathetic nervous system. So you can create a calming response or a relaxed response by just massaging these areas. Another area that, you know, with horses we frequently focus on is just behind the shoulder, what we call the wither of the horse, is an area where, you know, the horse just can't reach that area easily. So it feels so good when somebody scratches or rubs that area. You'll notice horses a lot, if they're alongside one another, they'll rub behind each other's shoulders. And it's just like that one spot in the middle of your back that you just can't get. And when somebody else gets that for you, you're like, oh, yeah, such a relief.
So the horse goes back to the herd of horses and says, oh, my gosh, I just had a session with Lola. It was wonderful, you know. And but I think that's important. And I know, let's talk a little bit about the dogs, too. I know Ellen now is... She's 12 and a half, and she's retired, and she really runs the household. She gets along very well with Maya, but I know she has some arthritis, and I notice a little more problems getting up, where she could used to jump on the bed. She has a heart. Is that, so you do that kind of thing, too, where you would massage the muscles on the dog and, you know.
Yep, and working with the joints as well. And also there's a connective tissue system, the fascial system, that actually has a lot of involvement or contributes a lot to some of the stiffness and immobility that we see with age. So we can work with dogs that are, and frequently that's the first time we'll meet new clients in many cases, is when they do start to see their pets not engaging in the same level of activity or struggling with certain activities like getting on the furniture, getting up on the bed, maybe getting in and out of the car becomes difficult. So we look at everything about the dog. Are there certain times of day that are harder for them? Is it certain activities that they do? Is it after they've done activities that they start to exhibit pain or soreness or difficulty? Sometimes it's after, you know, they've had a good night's sleep, but then they get up in the morning and they're stiff. So each dog is unique because the way their conditions develop is unique. And so we have to tailor the massage to suit their specific needs, whether it's physical or they also, like people, will tend to anticipate pain or discomfort with certain activities. So even though we might address the pain, you know, through medication or supplements or things that help to change the experience of pain, we also have to change the anticipation or the expectation of pain or discomfort to get that animal back to its normal activities.
That makes sense to me because I know once Ellen tried to jump on the bed and couldn't quite make it, now she really avoids it.
Yep.
And I also know that when I talk to the vet, you know, it kind of sounded like my regimen of vitamins and things that I take, you know, give her something for the joints, give her, you know, if she itches, she can have a little bit of Benadryl at night, something like that. Also, her pills are much more expensive than mine, too, you know.
Certainly. And it is important to note, like, all of those things are very important. As I mentioned before, we work closely with the veterinarians and other professionals. As a matter of fact, it's often a great resource for the veterinarians if you're working with a massage therapist, because we tend to be a liaison between the home and the clinic. So if your animal, for instance, is prescribed medication for pain or for arthritis or any other kind of condition, massage can actually help with metabolism of that. It helps their body adjust to the new medication, and it also helps to flush out any waste products and things that accumulate that can diminish the return or the diminish the benefit you're getting from the medication. So massage can be a really valuable tool. And when we go into people's homes, I mean, right now it's a little difficult, of course, with the time that we're in. We do a lot of yard calls instead of home calls, where I might be seeing the pet out in the yard or in a part of the house without as close interaction with the owners as I once had. But we still get to kind of see a glimpse into the animal's home life, and we might be able to have conversations with the owners because we're spending more time with the dog about how things are going with a new medication or a new exercise regimen, or how their appetite is, what their coat looks like. And then that information, we're able to relay that to the vet, or at least maybe point out to the owner, like, hey, here's something I'm noticing. Like, your dog's been on a certain medication for a period of time, and their coat seems drier, or their skin is a little more itchy, and that maybe is associated with the medication. So we might be able to help them with, like, knowing what questions to ask for their vet to see if maybe they need their dosage adjusted, or maybe they need an alternate medication that'll give them the same benefit but with different side effects. So it really can be valuable. A lot of people, whether it's for horses, dogs, cats, whatever animal you have in your life, I caution people about waiting until the animal seems to be in distress to start a program with a massage therapist, because a lot of the work we do is preventative in nature, or it helps to uncover things when they're just starting out, or when they're still really manageable. So the further we get into a condition, whether it's a psychological situation or a physical situation, the less options we have in managing it. If we get it early, a lot of times we can do a lot to manage it.
And I always wish that my dog was like, you know, Scooby-Doo. He could actually, well, here's what the problem is, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
but
that doesn't happen. You mentioned in the article that you've worked from aardvarks to zebras.
Zebras,
yeah, and everything in between. Tell me some of the different animals that you've worked with.
Yeah, well, let's see. Probably
start with aardvarks and then work your way to zebras.
Yeah, I worked with an aardvark at a zoo in Florida who had fallen from a tree. So he had had a broken leg, and he had recovered, but he had some leftover immobility related to that, and it prevented him from engaging in some of his, you know, favorite activities. So we worked with him over a series of sessions to help with that. Let's see.
So if I have an aardvark, I should not let him climb a tree, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, that sometimes they do. That's
they
know
do.
That can be part of their natural behavior. So I've worked with sloth. Probably my favorite animal next to horses is giraffe, and I've had the opportunity to work with several giraffe, including the recent newborn giraffe at Woodland Park Zoo last year.
And they moved her to a different zoo.
Yeah, Hassani is now in Texas, partly because he is an intact male. He's a breeding male, and Woodland Park Zoo already has a breeding male, and his father. And so, you know, he had better opportunities, and he could live a fuller lifestyle at the facility in Texas. So, but he really thrived at Woodland Park Zoo as well, despite being born with some deformities that could have been life-threatening. So the zoo team there worked diligently to create a situation where he could thrive.
That's interesting, because I used to take groups of graduate students back to Washington, D.C., and we went out to the
Smithsonian,
the Smithsonian National Zoo there. And I know one of the docents really, really closely. And one of the things that they mentioned with sharing with zoos is that the primary medication given to animals at the zoo are essentially birth control pills.
Yeah.
Because they really, and now there's much better system so that you're not just letting a group of animals inbreed and right. causing some of the physical problems that you have yeah. with that.
One of my earliest work experiences, I worked for Busch Gardens Zoological Park in Tampa, Florida, out of college, fresh out of college. And I got an opportunity back then to work on a software program that was linking all of the zoos across the world that were participants, linking their breeding populations so that we could, you know, if we had a white rhinoceros female, but we didn't have a male, then we could, you know, link with a zoo in Germany or something to access male. And you're right, we have to manage those types of populations. We don't want overbreeding. We want to have, you know, specific breeding programs for specific types of animals, and being able to connect zoological collections in a way that makes sure that we can access the best gene pool is really valuable.
And I know that there's a long way to go with zoos. Because I remember as when I was young and, mm-hmm. you know, there were in Ellensburg, they would bring a circus in and, yeah. you know, and animals weren't necessarily mm-hmm. always treated right. But overall, how do you feel about, I mean, this is just kind of a personal question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you feel about the zoos? I know they're trying to, I know at the zoo in D.C., they were trying to make more natural habitat, more right. space. How do you, what is?
It is, it can be a moral dilemma, and I've fallen on both sides of the fence on it. As a matter of fact, I left the zoological world back when I was younger because I had a conflict with the captive breeding of white tigers, and I just couldn't rationalize the benefits. So, but years later, I returned to the zoological field and working with people I had met during my time at the zoos to be able to bring massage into the zoos. You know, we go into several zoos across the nation and teach zookeepers massage so that they can, it can benefit the animals' enrichment programs. It can benefit them from, you know, the hospital staff being able to minimize stress and anxiety for animals undergoing veterinarian procedures. We had, for instance, I worked with a group of gibbons, which is an old world ape, and we were teaching them to volunteer for blood draws so that the zoos didn't have to sedate them in order to get a blood draw, because the zoos are required to do, you know, certain procedures on a regular basis. And so getting the animal to do it voluntarily is a lot less stressful and easier for everybody. So we used massage and food motivators to help teach them that. So I do think the zoos are coming a long way. They have a long way to go, but I guess that's true just about any aspect of the human race you can identify. We're always hopefully improving.
Do you think that also the massage helps the animal bond with the person?
There's so many research studies that indicate that massage is as good for the giver as the receiver.
Right.
So there are specific physiological things we see when people are giving massage. It also boosts our serotonin production. It helps with, you know, it excites the pleasure center of the brain. So there's lots of benefits on both sides.
Well,
I think animals get the bulk of it.
I think at this time with COVID, we all need to have, we could all need an extra helping of serotonin in our brain. And with that, I think we're going to end this session. Again, we've been interviewing Lola Michelin. I was going to use a joke. She never gets tired with this job, but But thank you very much. This is Dr. Steve Nurse. This has been Isabled, and this is our bonus episode on Section 1. Thank you.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.